$53.6 billion.
That is a, I mean, that's a very, very large number.
It is a staggering number. It's basically the GDP of a small European nation.
Yeah.
It's enough to buy a major professional sports league outright. But here is the statistic that actually made me, stop in my tracks this morning while I was drinking my coffee. That $53 billion is sitting in exactly nine positions,
Nine.
nine stocks. That's it.
Wow.
No hedges, no hidden derivatives, zero cash. Every single dollar is fully deployed.
When you do the math on that, it's roughly $6 billion per idea on average.
Right. It's the kind of concentration that makes you sweat just looking at it. I mean, most mutual funds hold 100 stocks. Even aggressive hedge funds usually hold 20 or 30 just to, diversify the risk a bit. But this is a high wire act without a net. We are talking about Sir Chris Hahn, of course, and TCI Fund Management. And as of today, February 26, 2026, the filings are out, the analysis is in, and it paints a picture of what might be the most aggressive yet calculated portfolio in the entire hedge fund industry.
It really looks like a high wire act from the outside for sure.
Yeah.
But I think what we're going to find today as we peel back the layers is that it's actually incredibly defensive.
Defensive.
Yeah, defensive. It looks risky because of the concentration, but when you look at what he's actually holding, the specific business models themselves, it's a fortress. It's a bunker.
Well, that is exactly what we are here to unpack. We are doing a deep dive today into a brand new piece of analysis that just dropped this morning. It's a blog post titled "What Chris Hahn's Portfolio Reveals About the Hierarchy of Toll Booths," published today on averagingup.com by Jocelyn Dubay.
And this is a really significant piece of writing because it connects the dots between high-level theory and actual boots-on-the-ground capital allocation. For those who have been following along with us, you'll know that this post is part of the Averaging Up collection. These are the mental model essays that accompany Dubay's book, The Infinite Investor.
Yeah, and if you haven't checked out the book yet, it's available for free at averagingup.com. It's effectively a masterclass in survival-first investing. But today, we aren't just talking about the abstract theory found in the chapters of a book.
No, we're seeing it in practice.
Exactly. We're watching Chris Hahn apply that theory in real time with $50 billion on the table. This is the case study.
Exactly. We are looking at Hahn's portfolio through Dubay's specific lens. We're going to talk about free surfers, we're going to talk about accretion monopolies, and we're going to look at this fascinating concept of capital migrating up the gradient.
That phrase really stuck with me. Capital migrating up the gradient. It sounds like physics.
In a way, it is physics. It's the physics of compounding. Just like water flows downhill, smart capital flows toward efficiency.
So, our mission today is simple but deep. We want to decode why Hahn is making the specific moves he is making. Why is he selling railroads? Why is he buying credit ratings? And most importantly, what does this hierarchy of toll booths mean for you? Because presumably, you aren't managing $50
And
billion.
honestly, the lesson for the small investor at the end of this is probably the most surprising part. Because as we'll see, there are structural traps that Hahn is stuck in because of his massive size, which you and I are not.
Okay, let's get into it. Before we look at the specific tickers and the buy and sell orders, we have to lay down the framework. In The Infinite Investor, Dubay introduces a way to decompose a business that I found incredibly helpful. It's a simplification, but it reveals so much. It involves just two variables, A and B.
Right, it sounds simple, almost too simple, but it completely changes how you look at a P&L statement. So let's break it down. A is the revenue a business generates from its existing operations.
Okay.
The stuff it's already built, the customers it already has, the contracts already signed, that's the money coming in the door today.
So that's the cash flow. That's the engine running at idle.
Correct. But then you have B, and B is the killer variable here. B is the incremental capital required to generate the next unit of growth.
The cost of growth.
Exactly. If you want to grow revenue by another $1 million, how much money do you have to spend to make that happen? Do you need to build a new factory? Do you need to lay new track? Do you need to buy a fleet of trucks? Or do you need to do
Yeah.
nothing?
Exactly.
Nothing.
And the golden rule here, effectively, is that the lower the cost of B, the better the business.
Precisely. The less you have to spend to grow, the more you get to keep for shareholders.
Yeah.
And this leads us to the concept of the free surfer.
I love this term. It feels very Californian, like you're just out there catching waves.
It's evocative, right?
Yeah.
A free surfer is a business where B is effectively zero. It's a business where growth costs nothing.
Which sounds impossible. I mean, in physics, you can't get something for nothing. Thermodynamics forbids it. You can't create energy without input.
In the physical world of atoms, yes, if you want to move more freight, you need more trains, that's physics. But in the world of networks and information, the world of bits, the rules change. The archetype here, and this is a major holding for Han, is Visa.
Okay, let's look at Visa, because I think we take it for granted. We swipe the card, the beep happens, we move on with our latte, but structurally, what is happening there?
Think about the wave. Global electronic payments are growing at roughly 8 to 10% per year. That's just the secular shift from cash to digital, global GDP growth, inflation. It all pushes that volume up. That is the wave.
And Visa is riding it.
Visa is the board. But here is the magic, and this is where the B equals zero concept clicks. For Visa to capture that 8 to 10% growth in volume, what do they have to do? Do they need to build more servers? Do they need to lay fiber optic cables? Do they need to take on credit risk?
No. The network is already there. The rails are laid. The terminals are at the coffee shops.
Exactly. If I spend $100 or $1,000, the electronic impulse traveling through the network is identical. The cost to Visa is effectively zero. They don't lend the money. That's the bank's problem. So they don't have credit risk. They don't build factories. They just ride the wave. Their revenue grows 10% and their capital expenditure grows 0%. That is a freebie.
It's the ultimate leverage. You aren't leveraging debt, you're leveraging the existing infrastructure to capture pure upside. It's essentially infinite scalability on the margin.
That's it. And think about inflation. This is a crucial point for the current economic environment. If the price of your coffee goes from $4 to $5 because of inflation, Visa's fee goes up proportionally. Did they have to do any work to get that raise?
No, they just took a percentage of a larger number.
Exactly. It's an effortless hedge against inflation.
Now, to understand why Han is moving the way he is, and why this portfolio is so fascinating, we have to contrast the free surfer with the other type of monopoly. Because Han likes monopolies, but he seems to be preferring a specific type of monopoly. Dubé calls the other kind the accretion monopoly.
And the poster child for this one in Han's portfolio is GE Aerospace.
Now, GE Aerospace isn't a bad business. We aren't bashing it here.
No, absolutely not. We had to be very careful here. Dubé makes this explicitly clear in the analysis. GE Aerospace is a phenomenal business. It has a massive moat. It operates a duopoly on jet engines with Pratt & Whitney. You literally cannot fly a commercial plane without one of them.
It's a toll booth on the sky. If you want to go up, you pay GE.
It is. But think about the cost of B. To maintain that duopoly, to get the next generation of revenue, GE has to develop the LEP engine, or the GE9X. Do you know how much that costs?
I imagine it's not cheap to defy gravity. We are talking about high-performance engineering.
We are talking about $15 billion and 15 years of R&D.
$15 billion before you sell a single engine.
Just to stay in the game, just to capture the next wave of travel demand, they have to reinvest massive amounts of heavy capital atoms, metal, titanium engineering hours just to grow. That is an accretion monopoly. It grows by accumulating more capital. No. It gets bigger, but it gets heavier.
So if we look at this hierarchy that Dubé lays out in the post, we have a tier system. It's not about good versus bad. It's about structural efficiency.
Yes. Let's visualize it as a pyramid. At the top, tier one, you have the free surfers. B equals zero. Visa, MasterCard, S&P Global, Moody's, MSCI. These are the kings of capital efficiency.
The pure information toll booths.
Tier two is the hybrid. Moderate B. Think Microsoft or Alphabet. They are incredible businesses, truly world-changing, but think about Azure or Google Cloud. To sell more cloud space, what do they need?
They need data centers. They need those massive server farms.
They need GPUs. They're pouring billions into NVIDIA chips and concrete bunkers to house them. So B is not zero. It's a light B compared to a railroad, but it's real. It costs money to grow.
And then tier three.
Tier three is the accretion monopoly. High B, GE Aerospace. The railroads, like CN Rail or CP Kansas City ASML.
And again, the key insight here isn't that Tier 3 is bad.
No, they are monopolies. They are wonderful businesses that will likely be around for 50 years. But structurally, purely mathematically, Tier 1 is superior because the cost of growth is zero. And capital, over time, acts like water. It wants to go where the friction is lowest.
So if you have a choice between a business that needs to spend $15 billion to grow and a business that needs to spend zero to grow, and both are monopolies.
You choose the one that spends zero every single time.
Okay, so that's the theory. We have the free surfer versus the accretion monopoly. Now let's look at the movie, because as Dubé points out in the post, the 13F filings, these quarterly reports of what the fund holds, they aren't just snapshots. If you line them up, they tell a story of migration.
It's a film in motion. And we look at Q2, Q3, and Q4 of 2025. The direction of travel is undeniable. Han is on a mission. He is actively re-architecting the portfolio.
Let's break it down quarter by quarter to see the logic unfold. Take us back to Q2 2025. What started happening?
In Q2, we see the first cracks in the Adams thesis. Han starts selling CN Rail. He sells almost 4 million shares. He trims CP Kansas City. He even trims a little bit of GE Aerospace.
Okay, so he's lightening up on the heavy stuff. What is he buying with that money?
He's buying Visa, plus 2.4 million shares. He buys S&P Global. He buys Moody's.
So selling rails, buying ratings, selling steel, buying data.
Exactly. It's a subtle shift at first. But then Q3 comes along and the move accelerates. This was a shocker. In one quarter, he increased his Visa position by 47%.
Nearly 9 million shares. That is a massive conviction bet. That's billions of dollars moving in 3 months. That's not just topping up. That is a statement.
It's huge. And to fund it, because remember, he has no cash. He is fully invested. He had to make room. He sold 41% of his Alphabet stake, 18% of CN Rail, and more of CP Kansas City.
He slashed Alphabet. That's a tier 2 hybrid.
He did. He sold a tier 2 and a tier 3 to buy a tier 1.
And then Q4, just to hammer it home.
Confirmation. He doubles down on the credit ratings duopoly, buying more Moody's and more S&P Global.
So the pattern is staring us in the face. He is systematically selling physical monopolies tier 3 to buy information toll booths tier 1.
He is selling good to buy better. He is moving from atoms to bits. He is migrating up the gradient.
But I want to pause on the zero cash constraint, because I think it forces a discipline that most investors, certainly most retail investors, don't really feel.
It's the crucible of the strategy. Most funds hold 5, 10, maybe 20% cash. If they see a good idea, they just use the cash. It's easy. It's painless.
Right. Oh, Visa looks cheap. I'll buy some. You don't have to sell anything. You don't have to make a hard choice.
Han doesn't have that luxury. Because he is fully deployed, every single buy order requires a sell order. He can't just say Visa looks good. He has to say Visa looks better than CN Rail. He has to say Visa looks better than Alphabet.
It's a cage match.
It is. Every dollar is fighting for its life. And this introduces the concept of opportunity cost in its rawest form. Even though CN Rail is a great monopoly, it owns the tracks, nobody can compete with it. Every day that a dollar sits in CN Rail, it is not compounding at the rate of a free surfer.
Because CN Rail has to pay for its growth. It has a compounding penalty attached to it.
Right. So even if CN Rail returned 12%, which is a great return, by the way, if Visa returns 16%, because it has no capital requirements, that 4% spread compounded over 8 years, which is Han's average holding period, is massive.
Let's do the math on that. A 4% difference over 8 years.
It's the difference between doubling your money and tripling it. It creates a massive divergence in wealth. Han is basically saying, I refuse to pay the penalty of holding a capital-intensive business when I can hold a capital-light one.
It's ruthless efficiency.
It has to be. At $53 billion, you can't afford nostalgia for a stock. You can't just hold it because you've always held it. You have to follow the physics of the return.
Speaking of ruthless efficiency, let's talk about his other major concentrated bet. We've talked about Visa, but his position in the credit ratings agencies is fascinating. He owns Moody's, which is about 12.7% of the portfolio.
Yeah.
And he owns S&P Global, which is 11.5%.
Combine them and it's over 24% of the fund. It's effectively his largest bet.
$13 billion. Now, the rookie question here is why own both? Aren't they the same thing? If you believe in credit ratings, just pick the best one and ride it. Why duplicate?
This is where we get into the difference between an OR pair and an AND pair. This is a crucial distinction Dubé makes in the double swell analysis.
Okay, AND versus OR. Break that down for us.
Let's start with Visa and MasterCard. That is an OR pair. If you go to a coffee shop and buy a latte, you swipe your Visa OR, your MasterCard. You don't swipe both.
Right. I'm certainly not paying twice for my coffee.
Exactly. The merchant pays one fee to one network. It's a competitive duopoly. If Visa wins a transaction, MasterCard loses it. They are fighting for market share. Every swipe is a battle.
Got it. So owning both is just diversification. It's hedging your bets in case one screws up.
Precisely. But Moody's and S&P Global are a cooperative duopoly. They are an AND pair.
How so?
Imagine you are a corporation, say Apple, and you want to issue $500 million in bonds. You need a credit rating so investors know how safe those bonds are.
Sure. I need the stamp of approval.
Do you hire Moody's or S&P?
I assume I'd shop for the best price, maybe play them off against each other. Hey, Moody's, S&P offered to do it for half price.
You would think so, but no. You hire both.
Ooh.
Institutional investors, pension funds, insurance companies. Their charters often require two distinct ratings before they can buy the paper. Regulators often require two ratings. So on that $500 million bond issuance, Apple pays a fee to Moody's A&D, a fee to S&P Global.
That is wild. It's like a double tax.
It is exactly like owning both rails of a railroad track. The train literally cannot run on just one rail. It needs both. So they don't compete on price. They don't compete for the transaction. They share the transaction.
So if Han owns both, he is essentially capturing the entire tax on global debt issuance.
100% of the toll. It's a brilliant structural insight. He doesn't have to pick a winner because the market forces the customer to pay both. He just sits back and collects the rent from the entire industry.
But Dubé points out they aren't exactly clones, right? S&P Global is a bit of a different beast than Moody's.
Yes, and this is why the diversification within the duopoly makes sense. Moody's is very pure. It's mostly just the ratings business and some analytics. It's a pure play on debt issuance. It's a resilient free surfer because even in a downturn, companies issue debt to survive, so Moody's gets paid.
And S&P?
S&P Global is what Dubé calls a conglomerate of toll booths. It's the Swiss Army knife.
Right.
They have the ratings, which is the classic business. But they also own S&P Dow Jones indices. So every time you buy an S&P 500 ETF, S&P gets a cut.
Passive investing. That's a massive trend right now. The shifts from active to passive.
Exactly. Then they have market intelligence, which is data. And they have Platts, which is the benchmark for commodity prices. If you want to know the price of oil, you check Platts. So S&P is basically four free surfers in a trench coat.
Four free surfers in a trench coat. I like that image.
But the logic holds. Han owns both because they are cooperative. In Visa versus MasterCard, he made a choice. He picked Visa. He concentrated. But in ratings, he owns the whole monopoly.
It really highlights how specific his selection process is. He's not just buying good stocks. He's looking at the market structure. Is it competitive? Is it cooperative? What's the cost to be?
It's architectural investing. He's looking at the blueprints of the industry. He's asking who has the power. And in the bond market, the power resides with the duopoly.
Now, I want to pivot to something that might be the most controversial part of Han's strategy. We mentioned it at the top, zero cash.
The all-in approach.
This stands in direct conflict with some of the biggest legends in value investing. I mean, look at Warren Buffett. Berkshire Hathaway is sitting on something like $325 billion in cash.
A literal mountain of cash.
And in The Infinite Investor, Dubé even argues for this. He calls cash the infinite option, the right to buy when the market crashes. So is Han wrong? Or is he just playing a different game?
He's playing a different game with a different mathematical assumption.
Unpack that for us. Why would someone choose zero cash when the market is at all-time highs?
The infinite option of cash has a price. And that price is the return you forego by holding it.
The opportunity cost.
Right. Cash earns the risk-free rate, let's say 4 or 5% right now. A free surfer, like Visa or Moody's, structurally compounds at 12 to 18%.
That's a big gap.
It's an enormous gap.
Yeah.
That 8 to 13% spread is the premium you pay to hold the option of cash. If you hold cash for a year, fine. If you hold it for a decade waiting for a crash, the math destroys you. You've missed a doubling or tripling of your capital just waiting for a bargain.
So Han's view is that the right to buy cheaper later isn't worth the lost compounding now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But here is the nuance, and this is the aha moment for me.
Yeah.
In the post, Han does have a reserve. It just isn't cash.
Cash that compounds.
Yes. He treats his tier three holdings, those railroads we talked about, as his piggy bank.
Explain how that works. How does a railroad function as cash?
Think about the properties of cash. It's safe and it's liquid. Well, CN Rail is a monopoly. It's relatively safe. It's liquid. You can sell it any day. And it earns, let's say, 10 to 12% a year. That is a lot better than the 4% you get from a treasury bill.
So instead of cash sitting dead, he puts his waving money into railroads. He parks it in a moving vehicle.
Correct. And then when the fat pitch arrives, when Visa becomes incredibly attractive, as it did in 2025, he liquidates the railroad to buy the Visa.
He cashes out the cash that compounds?
He upgrades the capital. So he has this hierarchy of states for a dollar.
Walk me through the hierarchy.
The worst state for a dollar is cash. High opportunity cost. It dies a little bit every day due to inflation. The better state is a Tier 3 accretion monopoly. It earns a good return, it protects purchasing power, and serves as a reserve. The best state, the final destination, is the Tier 1 free surfer.
So capital should always be trying to get to Tier 1.
Always. It's an uphill migration to the top of the quality ladder.
But here we have to talk about the risk, because the hosts of a finance deep dive cannot just say spend all your cash without a warning label. This sounds great when the market is going up. What happens when the floor falls out?
No, absolutely not. And Dubé is very clear about this in the book. This strategy works beautifully until the market breaks.
2008 style.
In a true crash, correlations go to one. Everything falls. If you hold cash, your portfolio stays flat while the market drops 50%. You look like a genius, you have dry powder, you can buy things for pennies on the dollar.
Right. But if you hold CN Rail as your cash...
So the market drops 50%, CN Rail might drop 40%.
So your reserve just shrank right when you needed it.
Exactly. That is the danger. You might have to sell your railroads at a loss to buy the thing you really want. You lock in a loss.
So Han is accepting that volatility.
He is. His bet is that the years of extra compounding earning 12% instead of 4% will create enough of a buffer that even if he has to take a haircut during a crash, he still comes out ahead of the guy sitting in cash for 10 years.
It's a mathematical bet on time versus timing. He thinks time in the market beats timing the market, even with his reserves.
And remember, Buffett is different. Buffett has $300 billion. He needs to deploy $50 billion at a time to move the needle. He needs a crash. He needs blood in the streets to get a good price on that kind of volume.
He needs a fire sale to buy the whole store.
Exactly. Han can move $100 million here, $100 million there. Ooh. He could be more nimble. He doesn't need the world to end to find an opportunity.
So Buffett needs an earthquake. Han just needs a tremor.
That's a great way to put it.
Let's move to section 5, position sizing. Because in the world of institutional investing, you can say whatever you want in a shareholder letter, but your portfolio weightings tell the truth.
Sizing is the final act of conviction. You can talk a big game, but where did you put the money?
So looking at the snapshot, the top 5 positions are 84% of the fund.
Extreme conviction.
But the number one spot goes to GE Aerospace, 27%. That's a Tier 3 accretion monopoly. Doesn't that contradict the migration thesis? If he loves free surfers so much, why is his biggest holding a jet engine manufacturer?
At first glance, yes, it looks like a contradiction. It looks like he's saying one thing and doing another. But you have to look at the flow, not just the current weight.
The flow.
GE is his biggest holding because he bought it a long time ago, likely at a great price, and it has compounded. It's an irreplaceable asset. He loves the moat. He's not going to dump it just because B is high. He knows it's a great business.
But he isn't buying more.
Exactly. Look at the marginal capital. Where is the new money going? Or where is the recycled money going? It's not going into GE. It's going into Visa, Moody's, S&P.
Ah, I see. So the legacy position is the heavy industry, but the growth vector is the light industry.
He's letting GE ride, but he's actively building the free surfers. He's trimming the rails to feed the toll booths. That tells you where his conviction for the future lies.
It's really interesting to see how sizing reflects that nuance. It's not just, I like this stock. It's how much capital does this stock deserve relative to its cost of growth.
And clearly, he believes the zero-cost growth deserves the fresh capital.
Okay, we've covered what he owns, but I want to talk about what he doesn't own, because this leads to what I think is the most empowering part of this deep dive for you, the listener.
The prison of size.
There is a classic Tier 1 free surfer that is missing from Han's list. We've talked about Visa, Moody's, S&P, but where is MSCI?
Yes. MSCI is arguably the most perfect business model on earth. It's an index monopoly. If you run an international fund, you pay MSCI. High margins, pure IP. It's a business, not an atom business. It fits every single one of Han's criteria.
So why doesn't Chris Han, the guy chasing free surfers, own it?
He can't.
He has $53 billion. He can buy anything. He could buy a small country.
That's exactly the problem. He has too much money. MSCI's market cap is around $45 billion.
Okay.
For Han to take a meaningful position, let's say a 3% position in his fund, which is about $1.6 billion, he would have to buy 3.5% of the entire company of MSCI.
Oh, that's substantial.
You can't just walk into the market and buy 3.5% of a company without sending the stock price to the moon. And you can't get out without crashing it. He is too big for the door.
He's trapped.
He is trapped by his own success. This is the liquidity trap. He is forced to stick to the mega caps, Microsoft, Alphabet, Visa, GE. because they are the only pools big enough for his whale-sized capital.
But you, listening to this, most of you aren't managing $53 billion.
And that is your edge.
Being small is a moat.
It is. If you are managing $10,000 or $100,000 or even $10 million, you don't have this problem. You can buy MSCI. You can buy the small free surfers that Han can't even look at because they're too small.
So we can actually build a better version of Han's portfolio than Han can.
Yes. You can own his best ideas, Visa, Moody's PLES, the things he is structurally banned from owning. You can own the pure version of the double swell.
Wait, double swell? We haven't defined that yet.
Ah, right. It's another concept from the Dubé universe. It basically refers to businesses that have two tailwinds. For MSCI or S&P, it's the shift to passive investing plus the AI revolution or data analytics growth. It's when the tide is coming in from two directions at once.
And Han gets exposure to that through S&P Global, right? Because they own the S&P 500 indices.
Correct. He settles for the bundled version. He buys S&P Global because it's huge and liquid, and he gets the index business tucked inside. But you can buy MSCI directly. You can target the pure play.
That is a massive psychological flip. Usually we think the billionaires have all the advantages. Insider access, better data, faster computers.
But in the game of compounding, agility matters. And when you are the size of an aircraft carrier, you cannot turn tight circles. The small boat can. You can go into the tributaries where the aircraft carrier runs aground.
So if you're looking at your own strategy, don't just copy Han's 13F. Use his logic, but apply it with your freedom.
Exactly. Take the hierarchy of Tollbooth's framework, but apply it to the whole market, not just the mega caps. Don't let his constraints become your constraints.
I love that. Okay, we are coming into the home stretch here. I want to synthesize this. We've talked about A versus B. We've talked about the migration from atoms to bits. We've talked about the cooperative duopoly. What is the core takeaway? What is the gradient we keep mentioning?
The gradient is this universal truth in investing. Over the long run, capital migrates to where the cost of growth is zero.
It's like gravity.
It is. Think about it. GE is fighting gravity. It has to lift heavy metal engines into the sky. It costs billions. Visa is defying gravity. It floats on the digital network.
And Han's strategy is simply to align his portfolio with that physics.
He is conceding that while he is a genius stock picker, he cannot beat the structural advantage of a free surfer. So instead of fighting it, he is joining it. He is selling the heavy stuff to buy the light stuff.
It's not about guessing stock prices next week.
No. It's about owning the best business models for the next decade.
And doing it with the discipline to say, I will hold zero cash because I trust these models to compound faster than any reserve I could hold.
That's the conviction.
So let's wrap this up. Recap the Han portfolio for us one last time.
9 positions. 0 cash.
Strategy.
Sell atoms like rails and engines. Buy bits like data, ratings, and payments.
The secret weapon?
The cooperative duopoly. Owning both Moody's and S&P to tax the entire debt market.
And the reserve currency.
Cash the compounds. Using Tier 3 monopolies as a holding tank for capital until a Tier 1 opportunity strikes.
And the edge for you, the listener.
You can fit through doors. Chris Han can't. You can own MSCI. You can own the small pure toll booths.
It is a masterclass in portfolio construction. And frankly, it makes me want to go look at my own portfolio and ask some hard questions.
Like, why am I holding this heavy business?
Exactly. Why am I paying for growth when I could get it for free?
That is the question.
Before we sign off, I want to remind everyone again where this deep dive came from. The blog post is What Chris Han's Portfolio Reveals at averagingup.com. It is a central reading.
And while you are there, grab the book, The Infinite Investor. It explains the full taxonomy, classic free surfers, resilient free surfers, the whole deal. We really just scratched the surface today.
And look out for the other deep dives on the site. There is one specifically on the double swell and another on position sizing that goes way deeper into the math of conviction.
Highly recommended.
I'll leave you with this final thought. We spend so much time analyzing good companies versus bad companies, but Han proves that in the universe of compounding, good is actually the enemy of exceptional.
That's it.
The cost of growth, that B variable, is the only thing that separates the very good from the exceptional. So look at your portfolio. Are you holding on to physical monopolies because they feel safe? Or are you ready to migrate up the gradient?
Are you paying a price for growth that you don't have to pay?
Something to think about. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll catch you next time.
See you then.